Hey everyone, I'm Chris Hall and this is the Downtime Podcast, where we take you inside the world of mountain biking, meet the characters involved, hear their stories and find some insight to help us all get faster on our bikes. This week's episode is supported by Hope Technology and we're going to be chatting to their fifth ever employee, Alan Wetherill, about the last 30 years at Hope. Without our supporting partners, I wouldn't be able to keep bringing you this podcast for free. So a massive thanks to Hope on this occasion and everyone else who supported us so far. You can find out more about Hope over at hopetech.com. We're always looking for supporting partners, so if you're involved with the industry and want to get involved and work with me, then just drop an email to chris@downtimepodcast.com. I'd love to hear from you. All right, quick bit of admin before we get stuck into this week's episode. All the links that we mention in our episodes are in the show notes. You can find those on our website, downtimepodcast.com. There, you'll also find a subscribe page to help you subscribe to the podcast and also to join our newsletter. That means you'll get each episode delivered to your device automatically as soon as it's available, and we'll keep you up to date with what's going on. If you want to help support what we're doing, then you can grab a t-shirt, hoodie, sweatshirt or mug on our web store at downtimepodcast.com/shop. Lastly, don't forget to give us a follow on social media where we're at Downtime Podcast, and please keep sharing the episodes and telling your friends about the podcast. I really love hearing from people who found the podcast because another listener has recommended it to them. So thanks to everyone who's been spreading the word. Right, it's time for this week's episode. We sit down for a chat with Alan Wetherill from Hope to chat about how Hope began, how it's grown to what it is today, what it's like to work at Hope, and much, much more. Also, we've got some information on how you can be amongst the first members of the general public to go on a tour of the Hope Tech facilities. So without further ado, here's Alan Wetherill. Alan Wetherill, welcome to the Downtime Podcast. Thanks for coming on.
No problem. Nice to see you.
Good stuff. So before we get into the story of Hope Technology, which is why we're here, just tell us a little bit about yourself and what it is that you do here.
I've been one of the fifth employees at Hope. So I've been here for 30 years now.
Yeah.
So I started off engineering, tool making. So as the company evolved into the bike side of things, I sort of naturally went that direction and started looking after the bike side. So now I just look after all the sales and marketing. So for many years I've been going around events and shops and just being involved in the bike side of Hope.
Yeah, so a well-travelled man.
Yes, yeah, do a lot of shows and a lot of events.
Excellent, good stuff. So yeah, you mentioned you've been there kind of pretty much right from the start. So yeah, wind the clock back and tell us a little bit about how it all got started. So it's your brother?
It's my brother Ian and yeah. Simon Sharp who started it.
Yeah.
In about 85, they were at Rolls-Royce and they were tool making there and they decided to leave and start their own tool making business because they used to ride motorcycle trials.
Right.
Their background. And the idea was they wanted to, when they started work in the morning, being in a week, at that time they wanted a good wage, would be £200 a week. They'd been happy with that. So they said, if we earn £200 a week by Thursday, we'll go riding motorbikes, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And then they said, weren't it by Tuesday, they'd do more days of riding. Anyway, so as Ian always says, he ended up, within the first week, they ended up doing sort of 18-hour days, 7 days a week, working, and seemed to forget the trials, the whole concept of it.
Yeah.
Because work just took over, gradually. They still rode trials bikes a bit. And then gradually we got into mountain biking on the back of the trials getting fitness.
Okay.
And at that time it was on rally Mustangs, were they?
It would be, yeah.
That sort of thing.
I had one as a kid, yeah.
Those sort of things. So they're all riding that type of bike. And that's about that time when the disc brakes on trials bikes.
Right.
So it was Owen, one of the lads who worked for us, decided, said, why can't I put disc brakes on mountain bikes? So he machined a little caliper. It was modelled on an actual clutch mechanism off a moped, the way that a worm drive inside it. So we used that, mechanical disc brake, and it worked. It was a bit quite industrial looking. And then we thought, well, we could sell this. So I think it was 1989 we started developing the brakes, and it was 1991 that we actually started selling them commercially.
Right.
So
impressive stuff.
Yeah.
And so what were they like to ride, those early brakes?
Well, at the time, they were really good. I wouldn't say they probably are now, but they were, yeah. Of an era.
Yeah. So it was all a mechanical brake at that point.
Totally mechanical.
Yeah.
And we actually, originally we used a rear hub. Was it Yeah, wheel hubs. We used to put the thread on one side and screw a disc onto that, on the threads on one side of the hub, and that's how we braked on it.
Yeah.
But then what we eventually started doing was machining our own hubs for it, which made it a bit easier to fit.
Yeah.
And that's sort of what took us into the mainstream. We were making hubs because the brakes were still, there's only us and Pro Stop. Mm-hmm. They were the only two around at that time. Then AMP brought some out. So it was real, sort of real, very niche brake.
Yeah.
But because we had to make hubs for the brakes, we started making standard hub, lightweight front hub, with cartridge bearings in. And that's what people started using, really. It was a time of Ring Glare were just starting, and Chris King was around doing mountain bike parts and all sorts of things. So it's all, we grew around that era, really.
Yeah. And so bikes at that point, they weren't ready for disc brakes, where they didn't have anywhere to bolt a disc brake to. How did you deal with that problem?
Jubilee clip.
Right.
Yes, it was. Yeah, they just basically wrapped around the fork legs and clamped around the side of it.
Yeah.
Eventually, Marzocchi put some mounts on the forks.
Right.
About it, and it started to build up then. Other people did it.
Yeah.
But it probably didn't, disc brakes didn't really take off until Shimano started doing them, because it becomes accepted then.
Right.
People start having, pretty similar to what's happened with road bikes, I suppose. As soon as some of the big players start making them, it becomes accepted.
Yeah.
So we can sort of follow along ways. We try to push it, but not necessarily the market leader as far as getting the mainstream using things.
So it was Shimano that managed to lobby the bike manufacturers and the fork manufacturers to get the kind of the mounts put onto the frames and the forks, really, then?
I would say so, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it did make a big difference with those. I mean, there was Hayes during that time and things like that. They were building things up, but I would say Shimano had that big push with the OEM manufacturers.
Cool. So you went to, was it the Anaheim show? Was that the first show for Hope Technology?
It was, yeah, Interbike. I think that was 91. We went there, and we had, at the time, I think we'd made 25 mechanical disc brakes, and probably at least 20 of them were around the show on different booths. It was all the brands wanted to show cutting edge. So it's when the shows used to really have, every single stand had to have a cutting edge product on it. It's not quite as groundbreaking now as it used to be at every show. It was when there was a Magic Motorcycles machine from Solid Bikes and all sorts of things. And our brakes, we managed to get the discs onto, so I say, 20 different stands around the show. So it looked like everyone thought we were a massive company. And we were literally at that point with five people. So it was pretty small.
Working in a tiny premises at that point?
Yeah, 400 square feet little building in, I think we were in Nelson at that point. Then we moved to Cong. And then we gradually got bigger. So Cong, like 20, 30 people. Then we moved to Barnoldswick. And we moved three or four times within Barnoldswick. So it's all grown gradually each time.
Yeah. And what was it? Did it make a profit straight away? Was it an easy sell turning up with that brake?
No, I said the engineering side of the business supported the fun side.
Okay, so this is the tool manufacturing for kind of Rolls-Royce Aerospace.
So, yeah, so we're doing quite, because this area, one of the good things about where we are in our local area, it's quite normal for engineering, aerospace engineers, because you had Rolls-Royce in Barnoldswick since the war, basically, started in there. And then you've got British Aerospace down the road as well. So there's real grounded into aerospace industry. So it's very easy to find engineers.
Right.
And a high quality of finish and that sort of thing. So it's quite normal in this area.
Yeah.
So we were supplying tools for those companies and like fixtures and measuring equipment for British Aerospace and for Rolls-Royce.
Yeah.
And all their subcontractors as well we did work for.
Yeah.
So, but the other thing we did as well, with some friends who do tuning parts for minis.
Okay.
So one of our big things was we were doing all the machining for Mini Sport in Padiham. So all the old original minis, and we made the 5-speed gearbox for them and adjustable suspension, and that was another thing that helped things along, because it was regular orders from them.
Yeah.
Helped the bike side.
Interesting. And how long did it take then to kind of get to a point where the bike part was significant enough to be making a profit and to become the focus for the business?
It sort of built up gradually, probably quite quickly, mid-90s, late-90s, it started to pick up quite a bit. Then early 2000s, we actually stopped doing other subcontract work on solely bikes, because we got to the stage where the aerospace side, because with Rolls-Royce, you had to be inspected every 6 months and do approvals and flight testing. It's not that we don't do all the testing for bikes, but you haven't got the same outside person coming in checking what you're doing. So it became quite onerous to all the inspections for less and less work for them.
Right.
So we ended up just deciding, oh, it's easy to do bikes all the time.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, cool. And it wasn't originally called Hope Technology, was it?
No. Basically, it was Inter Precision Company. So that was the tool-making company. And because we were going to start selling bike parts and went to America, we needed to create a limited company. So Ian and Simon, just trying to think of a name quite quickly, and the building we're in was called Hope Mill. So they just thought, oh, Hope Technology. So it's based on the building we're in. So every time we've moved now, we've renamed our building Hope Mill.
Ah, okay, so that's travelled with you.
Yes, yeah. Because in America, we always seem to be in old textile mills because of the area around here. That's sort of what's the background to the area.
Yeah, good stuff. So you mentioned hubs were a kind of obvious product, I suppose, because you needed something to bolt the discs onto. But then the Biggin hub came along, which is kind of like it's a standout product. It was very different to anything else out there. What drove that? Because it was quite a unique thing at the time.
Well, what we've done, a lot of our products develop from, we look around what's other areas, other businesses, like most people, brands, when they're making products for any industry, you'll always look at other uses of things and get inspiration for things. And the Biggin hub is actually, motorcycle hubs are quite often that design. So we thought, well, I can't put it onto a bike, because even the disc brakes, that was inspired by motorbikes. So we did the same thing with the hubs and try and get the strongest sort of hub we could build.
Yeah.
And that sort of shape was quite common on motorcycles. So we just sort of scale it down a bit. And the CNC machines we had allowed us to make some different shapes and things. So, because quite often as we've moved along, the different CNC machines we've got have allowed us to do different things. So it can open up avenues that you couldn't necessarily do before.
Yeah, okay, so the technology's progressed with the manufacturing environment.
Yeah, we do move on, because I think a lot of our products have got a bit slicker looking because of the capabilities of the machines we've got. You can machine a little bit nicer, do more things with them.
Yeah, cool, interesting stuff. So yeah, talk us a little bit through how the range has expanded. So started off with disc brakes, hubs is an obvious move.
Yeah.
But you've gone on to be, you know, producing a lot of different componentry.
Yeah, what we tend to do though, we'll always make something we want. This is what our ethos, well, it wasn't really creating an ethos, just what we did. We almost, everything we want, like disc brakes, we made for our own bikes. The hubs, really, we made for our own use. And the next one was headsets, because we kept buying headsets, like Mavic ones used to keep buying. I thought, well, we can make these. So we made a headset. And then, well, we might as well do seat clamps and things. So we made seat clamps. So we just kept making things we want to use. So it's back to the, I don't think people promote the fact that all these rider-owned companies, well, we always were rider-owned. You know, we made things because we wanted to ride them.
Yeah.
So that's why our range, if you look at the Hope range from, because like I say, brakes, hubs, handlebars, lights, everything, but all because we want to for ourselves. So they're not necessarily massive sellers in each area, but we're quite high up, well respected in every area, because there aren't many brands that have such a diverse range of products, really.
Yeah.
The other thing we tend to do as well, we don't do different qualities. We only make one version of something because we can make one. We want to make the best value that will work the best.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one we make. We don't make a cheaper version because it wouldn't be as good.
Yes. Yeah, I never really thought about that, but you don't have a tiered kind of, like, a cheap headset, a medium headset, and expensive headset.
It's like the brakes are only different because of the different uses.
Yeah.
They're not actually different, they're not different qualities, they're just different types of use. Yeah.
So I guess that is sort of the underlying philosophy then, whether you've kind of expressed that at the start or whether that's just what you've all done.
But. Yeah, just making it for ourselves, basically.
Cool, it works.
Yeah.
It does work. Yeah, good stuff. So, expansion into all kinds of different products, lots of different things over the years. What's, out of all of those, what's been the trickiest product to develop?
We sort of, every area has its own little intricacies and difficulties, I would say. But I suppose because predominantly we were using metallic parts and machine aluminium, that was our background, so we know that. Whereas the carbon, we were going into something that's almost outside our comfort zone because it was a new material.
Yeah.
But still, when we started looking into it, it's all still based on aluminium machined molds. Uh-huh. That's one of the critical things about it. So realistically, it was what most people find difficult about carbon was that the easiest bit for us making molds. So even that we can just sort of twist into our own knowledge and make working how we want to work it.
Yeah.
Because one of my brother Ian's his philosophies is tool makers always believe you can do anything. So that's his inherent thing, him and Simon, is just, yeah, you can turn hand to anything.
Excellent. Yeah, that's good. It's the right approach, isn't it? If you want to get things done,
yeah,
you got to have some belief.
Because the anodizing as well, it's another thing we did ourselves because we're looking at, we used to sub it out to a local firm, do sort of all the anodizing, but it meant transporting it somewhere else and bring it back in. So we actually decided it ourselves. And that was a case of, they actually got a book out of the library, worked out how to do it, made some tanks and started anodizing. And then it just took off from there and like we became an expert in anodizing.
Yeah. Very entrepreneurial spirit through the place, for sure. Yeah. So, tell us, you mentioned the carbon bikes. Tell us a bit about the background of that. How long did the project take to get to the... Because it was the HB160, the first.
Yeah, we started doing probably carbon... It was a seat post we're looking at as a product. But then in the background, there's always been... Ian Simon always wanted to make a bike because the number of times people come into the visit the factory who don't see it, your bike manager walks around and goes, well, you make bikes. Like, no, we make components. So we always have to make an excuse why we don't make bikes. We only make components because everyone who doesn't know the bike industry always assumed we must do bikes.
Do that a lot.
Yeah. So it was one of their sort of things that they both wanted to make a bike and Simon especially wanted to sort of design a bike. It started off in doing designs in aluminium and steel, even steel, because we knew the actual technology and the material.
Yeah.
But we still had to weld them. So we didn't really, that's not our background, isn't fabrication. So we never actually did any metallic frames. But then as the idea of carbon, we got a local consultant around who came, he used to work for like a troubleshooter for aerospace and F1 teams.
Okay.
He'd retired. He looked quite local. He was helping us sort of develop the seat post. And it was this, oh, we could do a frame ourselves. So it was never really a commercial thing. It was just, we'll have a go.
Yeah.
Making it for our own use, really. Because Ian was a bit fed up having to buy all the staff bikes.
Yeah.
So it was a case of, well, if we made them, it'd be cheaper, wouldn't it? So obviously probably not in the end, but that's how it all came about. So he sort of helped us design it, and then we got a few other people coming to work for us who knew about carbon and building bikes, and it just sort of all developed that way.
Yeah. So like you said, the bit that a lot of people find tricky is the mould manufacture for the carbon. So yeah. it's a big aluminium, kind of an inverted version of half of the frame, I suppose.
Yes.
How long does it take and how much does it cost to make one of those?
It's about a week's machining.
Complete 24/7?
During the day for that is.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's about a week of machining.
Yeah.
So it depends how you cost it. The material is about £800 or £1,000 for a block of material.
Yeah. Then plus the
time for machining, yeah. But we have the machines anyway, so we did actually buy a machine bigger because most of our components are quite small.
Yeah.
So we have quite a small envelope inside the machine to the machine, whereas obviously frame molds are quite large. So we had to buy a machine specially to do it, but it means we could do the swing arms to the frames and that sort of thing. So it's opened up more capabilities.
Yeah.
We've actually bought another machine, the same, to do more molds. So we've doubled the production on making molds because with the handlebars and with the other frames, it's sort of evolved a bit more.
And you've got a whole sort of dedicated carbon manufacturing area here now.
Yeah, because in the back of the building, we built a new extension, I think about 14,000 square feet. That was started building a couple of years ago, but that's where the tool room was going to go in there for making all the fixtures and things. But then we also put the carbon manufacturing in there. So that's sort of filled, well, it wasn't filling the space now, but it's pretty much filling it now.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and I was lucky enough to have a little look around there recently. And talk us through a little bit of the kind of the process of once you've made the mold, how do you then get a bike from that? And how long does that take? Because there's a lot of labor and a lot of love that goes into that.
It is. That's one of the big differences on with aluminium parts that we're both familiar with. If we want to up production or increase production, we just buy a new machine. And one guy runs five machines, six machines. It can sort of scale up quite easily. So it's not down to labour. Whereas carbon fibre production, it's down to people. It's just all hands on. There's no automation involved or anything. So it is literally having good staff and training them up. And just need, as we want to increase production, we have more staff.
Yeah.
But it starts off, you've got like a plotter can cut out the bare sheets of carbon, the different types of material. And then we're using pre-peg sheets or carbon composite, laminate into the molds. So do each half. It's a total of about 14 hours to do both halves of the mold. And then we put them together, goes into a between heat suppressors. It's about 3 hours in there. Mm-hmm. So we worked out it's about 40 hours to make a frame from putting the first piece of carbon into the mold to rubbing it down, lacquering it, yeah. decals, everything.
So it's about a week of someone's yeah. time in yeah. theory.
That's just the front carbon triangle. Obviously, yeah. then there's the machining of the aluminium swing arm and that sort of thing. So it soon adds up.
Yeah, yeah, it's a yeah. lot of work.
So we're doing, I think currently on the 160, we're doing about four a week.
Right.
That's the sort of production.
And is that capacity, or could you kind of make, could you make more?
Probably pretty much capacity, because okay. we're doing handlebars as well, so we're trying to up production on those. So it's the same. They are different people, but they tend to cross over between areas.
Yeah.
So it does, yeah. So it's probably a balance between keeping the production on different areas.
Yeah, interesting stuff. And you've recently launched or made people aware of the new bike, the HB130. So
yeah,
first 29er.
Yes. Yeah, it's because 160 was sort of as for a use of racing in the US World Enduro. That's what yeah. I sort of made it for. Whereas obviously things have moved on a bit, and really want a frame that you just ride generally around UK trail centres or Boris uh-huh. that sort of thing. So it's really the 130 will travel, 29er. It fits that bill. So it's again a bike for ourselves
yeah.
that just happens to be what other people hopefully want as well.
Yeah.
So we're working on that one. We're just trying to spec up the general idea at the moment, but that'll be production some June, July this year.
Okay, sure. not far off. Yeah,
so that's the plan.
Yeah, and how many do you go through a lot of iterations to get to where you're at with a bike like that? Or
we did interesting with the 160, we made one, and then the geometry stayed as it was, and we made a production version. It just altered the tree profile slightly, but geometry never changed, and it rides brilliantly. But obviously, at the time, it was not on fashion, on trend okay. with the geometry,
yeah.
but it rides really well. Because not necessarily the most fashionable geometry is not always just the best one.
Yes. Yeah,
so
yeah.
the 130, what we've done, because we're sort of developing quite quickly, we made one, we're on the fourth version now, actually. But this is another thing we do. With us making the molds, we can make one mold, and we'll test the geometry and ride it and see how it feels. But other manufacturers would make an aluminium mule or something, which they can weld up and mm-hmm. try different geometries and things like that. Whereas with those, because we don't weld, it's easier for us to make a mould. So we have gone through, we're on the third mould now. I think we're on the final one to be produced at the moment. So we're just the final testing around March.
Yeah.
That's why it's going to be June before we can actually do the production ones.
Yeah.
So I say it's the fourth.
Interesting.
Fourth version.
Yeah. And do you do all your own in-house certification for the frames? Or do you...
We do. We've done some outside because a couple in the German test centre and UK one can test frame just to get the ISO mm-hmm. approvals and that sort of thing. But we have bought our own test jigs as well. So we're just trying that at the yeah. moment on this frame.
What, for those people that don't know about those tests, what sort of things are the frames tested for?
The main one is just the impact on the front. They've got a front on the forks and the head tube and things like that. But then there's also lateral testing we do and stiffness of the frame. So it's quite an involved process.
Yeah.
And it's just trying to work out what's the correct...
Yeah, what's the right answer?
Yes, because it's all subjective, really, ultimately.
Yeah.
But for safety, first of all, but then also the actual longevity of the frame.
Yeah. Yeah, cool. Interesting stuff. Yeah, so we mentioned testing. I'm guessing that's changed quite a bit over the years. How back in 1991, when you were doing the first disc brakes, what sort of level of testing or what was being done to test the products back then?
Well, this is where Simon did his own testing. It used to be in Skelton Street in Colne. It's about one of the steeper streets in Colne, and our mill was on the side of this street. And basically, you would put the brakes on, it'd ride out of the factory on the bike, and then ride down the hill on the tarmac, pulling the front brake on, and seeing if it worked. So it was quite... Yeah, it was good testing.
Yeah,
but quite dangerous, really, in a way, because he's been out of a few bars a few times and things like that on the tarmac.
Excellent.
So yeah, we had some interesting times on that.
Yeah.
But then we do evolve. We've got quite a big team of riders always riding for us. There's the staff all ride have bikes provided by us to test as well, and then we've got a few outside people now and again. So we do a bit of lab testing, but ultimately it's still how it feels on the bike. Because with the, one of the things with brakes, ours are never the most powerful brake. Because on some magazine tests, when they test on the dyno, we'll always come middle of the pack, sort of as far as the actual dyno performance. But if you ride it, it's how it progressive it feels, which you can never test other than actually riding it. Because we always say that anyone can make a brake that locks up. It's the bit before it locks. That's the bit you want control on.
Yeah.
And that's the trick. And that's what we always to ride and test that way.
Yeah. Yeah, I can vouch for that. Actually, the first time I used the newest brake, it didn't feel that powerful.
No.
But then you just like apply a little bit more pressure through your finger and you've got this really controllable
That's what we're trying to
range.
So it also differentiates us from other brands, because other brands, they're quite on off. And if you like that, that's fine. But we tend to go more progressive.
Yeah, and it looks good in test results on a dyno, I guess.
But yeah, exactly.
Like you say, it doesn't necessarily translate. No. And that, I think that's probably one of the hardest points, right? Trying to understand what do people want from the product, how they're going to use it.
Yeah.
And therefore, how do we test versus that?
Yeah, well, this is one of the things we probably do a lot of times. We actually do try and go to more events that way, because to get feedback from people actually riding the parts. And this year, there's another good thing about doing the HP160s, we've got a demo fleet now as well. So we'll go around events. We're actually doing all over Europe, UK and America doing demos. So I get people actually riding the brakes. So once they've ridden them, that's all the convince then.
Yeah, good stuff. You mentioned the staff here. Tell us a little bit about this place. Like, how many people are working here? How big is it?
There's 155 people now.
Wow.
So probably about 20 people in the last few months. Because with the carbon, again, because it's such a labour-intensive thing, we've actually had to employ more people for that quite directly, whereas with aluminium expansion, it wasn't taking that many people on.
Okay.
So like 155, all on site here.
Yeah.
And it's just a lot more on the manufacturing side.
Yeah. And how big is the premises now?
We're about 105,000 square feet.
Wow.
But then we do also have another plot, 6 acre plot of land at the side of Van Allswijk, where we used to be. Actually, we bought the land back where we can expand and put more manufacturing there at some point if we want to.
Yeah, because you're basically at capacity here, near enough.
We are realistically. We're doing a few changes efficiency-wise, like machining. We can do a few little tweaks here and there. Again, one thing we tend to do is when we will upgrade machines quite often, because we spend probably at least £1 million a year, if not a bit more, on new machines every year. But we don't necessarily always just get added to machines, we will replace them.
Okay.
So there's rolling upgrades, because the new machines are always more efficient, we run faster, run quicker. So it does, it can improve productivity then as well.
Yeah. Give people a feel for like some of the new machinery that you've got down there.
Yeah.
Like what is it doing? What kind of stuff can it do? Because they're big bits of kit and they're not cheap. Eh?
No, well, the newest ones, all the 5-axis milling machines. We've used these quite a bit, the Matsuras, they've used quite a bit, and they've got 3 in the last couple of years, and they're £500,000 each.
Yeah.
But they'll run 32 pallets with different products on each pallet in the machine. But operating will load that up in the morning, and it'll run for several days, just picking out each part, but small batches we can run as well, because every pallet has 3 parts on, but every pallet could be different parts. So the flexibility on the machines, we run very small batch sizes. So we tend to run ideally very lean and not very little stock, and sort of almost manufacturing to order.
Yeah, yeah. So you can load the machine up with 32 times 3 numbers of components.
Yes. Yeah.
And the machine knows what it's picking up and will do the right operation for that.
That's it. There's a tool in the back of there as well. So down to the operator program, just getting things set up right.
Amazing.
So
And so how much material, raw material, comes through the factory every year at the moment?
I think it's currently about 250 tons of aluminium. Yeah. We do a bit of steel, but not much. It's mostly aluminium that we're working with. Obviously with the aluminium, with our parts, there's quite a bit goes out as waste scrap.
Yeah.
We try and cut it down where we can, like the extrusions for the calipers, there's forgings for the mass cylinders, forgings for the hubs, to try and reduce waste. It'll make them stronger, but it does reduce the waste as much as we can. But then 100% of the metallic waste we produce is recycled.
Okay.
So we try and do what we can there.
Do what you can, And what about the carbon side of things? Because that's a bit more challenging from a recyclability point of view.
Yes. No, we're looking at that one. First and foremost, we actually use sensible cutting of the material, so very minimal waste on natural material. Any waste bits, recently we've got quite a few offcuts at a reasonable size. We'll either use ourselves to make prototypes and mess around with different things, or some schools have used it locally for projects and things like that. So we're trying to cut down on it as much waste as possible on that side. But we are trying to look at how we can recycle the pre-pegged sheets when they're off-cut. There's ways of chopping up and doing things. We're trying to look at that one. But once the carbon's been moulded, it becomes a little bit more problematic. And there's a couple of companies in the UK, but it's the volumes. We almost need to do more before they'll start doing it. So it's a bit of a debatable thing at the moment.
Yeah, tricky one for everyone.
But the other thing we can do on our carbon, it's like the frames. If someone has one of our frames, even though we've never had one break, if something goes wrong with it, we can fix them, we can re-lacquer them, we can refurbish them. So they can last a long time in our frames. They're not disposable at all.
Yeah, compared to maybe some of the Far East stuff where you're not going to have that connection to someone that can fix it as easily.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
And you guys have always focused on making product that's kind of fully serviceable and easy to... maybe easy is not always the right word, but it's possible with the right level of skill and the right tools to maintain it and keep it going for a long time.
Yeah, if you have any skill, basically, we always try and make sure that all the parts bolt together. They're not pressed and screwed where they can do, well, not screwed and riveted if it can help it. So we try and make everything, like even the calipers, you can change all the pistons, the seals. And we've still got people sending brakes back from 20 years ago and hubs that want repairing. We've also got the bearings for those. We're limited, probably 20 years is about the limit on some of the spares, but some bits we've still got odd bits of mechanical brakes from 1990.
Interesting. I've got some very old Hope brakes in my garage. I'll have to bring them in and see if we can get them working.
You know, when we post pictures of people, of an old brake, and a number of people who say they're still using that same brake, still working perfectly.
Yeah.
It just needs a little bit of looking after now and again. But the idea is that very few have to be thrown away. They can be refurbished.
Yeah, that's really cool. And tell us a bit about what it's like to work at Hope then, because just walking around this place, there's bikes everywhere, like it bleeds bikes.
Yeah, we tend to be that if you weren't a cyclist before you started working, you will be very quickly. So we tend to get, quite a few years ago, it tend to be that the marketing department all had good bikes and everyone else in the factory had not great bikes.
Right.
So with people who knew the industry, they used to get the best stuff. So Ian basically decided quite a few years ago that no one's allowed to own a bike, that we would provide everyone with a bike.
Okay.
So now everyone on the shop floor has, they might have hopefully a new Hope bike now, but we can't make enough. But there's Santa Cruz, there's Scott's, there's all sorts of different bikes, whether they're cyclocross road bikes, mountain bikes, downhill bikes. So I think we've got about 350 staff bikes, maybe a few more actually, that the staff use. But it's like an extended test program. So you've got every type of rider, from a guy riding down the canal to someone riding World Cup downhills. So there's every level in the factory testing the products, and we can change things over quickly. But it also allows our warranty guys, we'll buy lots of different brands because they can fit parts onto the bikes when they're building them up for staff, but they'll learn any little intricacies about what bottom bracket fits that frame or what issues you've got with that different thing. So it gives us a bit broader knowledge on different areas as well.
Cool. Yeah, because you've got people here that build and then maintain the bikes for the staff as well.
Yes, yeah. Awesome. It's a bit good now and again if someone comes with a puncher.
Fair enough,
You try and punch a bit too long, but try and look after the bikes.
Yeah, and some cool facilities as well.
Yeah, we've got, every week we've got, there's a stretch and that yoga class on every week. There's a couple of circuit training classes after work go on. There's a Watt bike studio for training on, which is quite busy at this time of year, obviously in winter, but it's quieter in summer. Every month we do a staff ride. I mean, staff go out at least once a week, there's a staff ride, a small one, but then once a month we have a all factory staff ride, which you still get about 30, 40 people going on that one. It tends to be quite local. Then we finish off at the local cafe afterwards and have a few drinks and a bit of a social thing as well.
Nice. So. And a full-size snooker table.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah, the snooker table, got a full-size snooker table and a pool table as well.
How did you end up with a full-size snooker table?
That was when we moved in this building, because it was quite a bit bigger than, it was probably twice the size of our old building. So we've got a bit of spare space. And the guy who was fixing the roof was moving house, and he said, would you like a snooker table? So basically we paid a little bit extra to get the roof fixed, and he threw a snooker table into the deal. So that's how we ended up with that one.
Oh, fair enough. Yeah. Awesome. Yeah, some cool stuff. So I'm sure for a lot of people, working at Hope would be a bit of a dream job. what would be your recommendations to, if there's people out there that are listening that are thinking of, oh, I'd love to do something, you know, work somewhere like Hope, any advice for people?
It's difficult on that one, because we always say that the problem is, ultimately, we're realistically an engineering company who makes bike parts. Uh-huh. So other brands might be, you know, the design market, and they don't actually manufacture products. So that's where we're sort of different. So we, all the people working here have come from other backgrounds generally.
Right.
So we tend to be like, I'm an engineer.
Yeah.
And there's other people in, a lot of the sales and marketing roles are all from other areas, and they never tend to be from the bike industry.
Okay.
So a bit more of an engineering company. So we always say the way to get into our area is more, it's an engineering based thing. We've got a few mechanics who've come from bike shops and that sort of thing as well.
Yeah.
So there's all the opportunities that way.
Yeah. But a solid engineering background is a good place to start.
Yeah, because we like to, that's one thing, people on the phones, we always tend to have people answer the phone. We like not to have to put people through to different people.
Right.
Once the guy who answers the phone should know how to answer that question.
Okay.
So they tend to have a good grounding in all our areas, really.
Yeah. Okay, cool. And then over the years, you've worked with some pretty interesting people along the way.
Yeah.
I guess one of the people that most people listening to this will know is Adam Brayton.
Yes. He's
been with Hope a good few years.
He has, yeah. He rode our brakes when he first, I think, when he was racing sort of privateer, he used to ride our brakes and we sort of sponsored him a bit. And then it was probably one of the first factory riders for us. And then we've just kept him on with us ever since. He's part of the furniture, I suppose, really, isn't he?
Yeah, he must have had offers from other people, though. What do you think has kept him with Hope?
I think it's just the confidence in us that we're always going to, you know, we deliver what we promised to him. So we look after him. And I think he might have had better offers from people before, but we can stand by him, because he's had a few bad years on injuries and things, but he generally comes good. And
yeah.
He's looking good with all the training he's doing at the moment. I think
yes,
he should be
sure.
Good for this year.
Yeah, and a new bike under him as well. So
yeah, no, give him a kickstart, sort of just to refresh sometimes. I think you get this. It's not whether the bikes are better or worse, but I think sometimes you have to have that fresh feeling of just a new bike and a new challenge.
Yeah, shake it up a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then Martin Ashton, you famously supported through his road party work.
Yeah, no, right from, well, forever. The Martin and Martins, we used to sponsor them. When he was a Cannondale and stuff, they used to use our hubs, sort of thing. So it's all built up over the years.
Yeah.
And yeah, we've always supported him all that way. And then Danny McCaskill, he's been using our parts all the time. So he'll still use our hubs even now.
And the set of wheels that was built for Martin's road bike party survived, is that?
Yes, we've still got the bike here. So he lent us the bike from Road Bike Party 1. We actually have it home up in our social club. So it's still got the same wheels as it did the event. I think one puncture, so it was. So there's some carbon wheels out on there. They were quite strong carbon wheels, I must admit.
Still, that's quite impressive for what he was doing on that bike.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then obviously Guy Martin has been kind of flying the Hope flag in front of certainly the British television audience. I'm not sure about globally, but I'm guessing he's probably fairly well known globally as well.
He does get around a bit, certainly. Yeah, yeah. Certainly more travelling now.
Yeah. How did that come about? Because that's a bit more of an obtuse.
Yeah, link. No, it was a friend. It was our graphic designer and photographer used to use. He was doing some photos for Guy. Uh-huh. I think Guy at that time was riding Orange as well already. He was doing some mountain biking. And the chap we know who was doing the photos had mentioned to him, I'll have a word with Hope, you want to get some parts off them. So anyway, we supplied some brakes for him via Orange for his downhill bike. I think it was that six-hour downhill up at Fort William was doing.
Ah, yeah, okay.
We used to do things like that. And then ever since then, we've just done bits. And then one of the lads in sales got to know him quite well. And he's one of his best friends. Now there's a couple of them who go out riding with him quite often. So he's a friend rather than a sponsored rider, I would say. So he's always around. He's always an interesting character. We just sort of look after him with bits of bikes and clothing, obviously. He's famous for wearing the same shorts every time he wore them. We sent him new shorts every time, but he was insistent on wearing the same ones.
He's got a pair that he likes, and that'll do.
Yes. So we kept trying to find him, trying to get him the latest stuff, but he just still wears the same one. So,
excellent. Yeah. And he's going to be off on a HP 130 for some adventures.
He is. He's got, there's an American long distance event he's doing in April. So he's training up for that at the moment.
Yeah.
So he wanted to use one of our bikes. So we're kitting out a 130. But just taking the bottle cage thing too far, he wants three bottle cages on his bike, so we're having to reinforce the frame slightly to put some bottle cage in different areas. So he always has a different way of doing things.
Excellent. Adds his own engineering input.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Fantastic. And you've helped him out with some of his, like, he did the land speed record on a bike. You helped out a bit with that.
Yeah, that's what we end up doing on the TV programs. Tends to get people involved, consultants and things, then they come to us in the end and try and fix the problem. So it's like we designed who designed the drivetrain on that land speed bike.
Yeah.
Because he's trying to work out how to do it, and he worked out all the gear ratios for that one. And then we did the gravity descent thing as well.
Yeah,
so
okay.
They usually come to us when they've had problems and they can't get it to work.
Excellent.
So we fix them all and just make things up for them and solve the problem. Usually they need it for tomorrow as well. It's never plan ahead.
Yeah. So, yeah. And how important have some of those pro riders been for you throughout the years? Because I think there was a national champs back maybe 99, 2000 time where, like, was it the whole top 20 were on hope breaks?
We've had a lot of things like that, yeah. Yeah. I think it's just, we've always been based around going to events. So right from the very beginning, when I was doing the brakes and, well, the mechanical brakes, the hubs, we used to go to every national points cross country. Well, when they were the same weekend, there was a cross country, the downhill, all the same venue. So we used to go to all those events. So we've always been based around going to events and supporting riders. So we're always direct contact with them. And even when we're doing World Cups, we used to sponsor a few teams, like Giant Team and things like that, when Rob Warner were running for them.
Yeah.
But then it tended to be that other teams that had problems with their own brakes off other manufacturers, they'd come and see us at an event, or can we swap brakes? So quite often we had probably twice as many riders as we should have had because we all had problems with the brakes and we were sort of the reliable thing in the background and someone there to fix things. So we've always been around racing, really.
Yeah.
But we're never known for it in a way. It was always just, it just happened. I suppose a lot of time we did secret, not secret, but we didn't shout about it that much, really.
Yeah. Yeah. Hope's always been kind of just quietly getting on with its thing and people realise how good it is and then they stick with the product.
Yeah. I think it makes a big difference. People riding the product as well. That's what we've identified very early on, that people need to use the product and see it being used as well and have confidence in it, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah. So beyond the kind of racing stuff and the obvious support that you've had from the pro side of things, what do you put Hope's success so far down to? Is there any kind of certain things that you think have been a big part of that?
It's the people, I suppose, isn't it? Because they do actually, I mean, there's a lot of luck involved. There's no, as Ian would say, that don't ever think there's a plan, because it is just evolved. We've gone from one thing to the next. And it's this conviction of making things that we believe in and want to do for ourselves. You know, Simon and Ian, that was always their thing. Just almost every product they designed, they made and produced. It didn't matter if it had a market. We just had to make it for ourselves to work. And we'd always make it work. And I think that's the ethos we're trying. It gets more difficult the bigger you get.
Yeah.
But you still have to have that sort of drive and passion for the products you want to use, basically.
Yeah, yeah. And you're at capacity, like you said, basically here. Are there plans to move or to expand? You said you've got some space somewhere.
Yeah, there's a 6-acre plot of land we've got on the other side of town. So we're keeping Burnalswick because we still have a lot of our staff living in the town as well.
Right.
So we keep close by. Like I say, we have a good feed of engineers in this area as well, so it's no reason to move out from here. But the 6-acre plot we've got, if we need to expand the carbon, we think we could down there, maybe wheel building, a bit more room down there.
Mm-hmm.
But as Ian wants, there's a velodrome wants to build at some point. So we've got plans ready to go in actually for the velodrome with a manufacturing plant underneath it. So.
Wow, okay. So full size?
Well, not 200 metres.
Okay.
So it's big enough still.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but we're hanging fire on that
right
at the moment, just because we manage the space we're in at the moment, we can sort of get more efficiencies and just with the inevitable uncertainties in the industry at the moment and the economic climate, we're just taking our time just over the next year or so and seeing how things go, really.
Yeah.
And not risking anything, basically.
Right. But if that does go ahead, what are the plans for the velodrome? Is it for like the local community or?
Yeah, it all stemmed because Ian, basically, it's usual thing, wanted something for ourselves to use.
Yeah.
because he tried to book on Manchester Velodrome, and it was a 6 month waiting list. Yeah, on there because British Cycling use it. Tried to ring up Glasgow, the phone number didn't work for some reason. They couldn't work out what was going on. Anyway, they said, "Well, it can't be that hard." So anyway, decided we should build our own Velodrome because then you'd actually be able to get on the track.
Yeah.
And realistically, this area, you've got to go to Manchester. You've got to go into the city,
yeah,
which is always harder to get in there. Whereas we're in the outskirts, so to get out from Leeds and Manchester, there's something like 13 million people within about an hour and a half away.
Okay.
So it's a big, massive catchment, and it's easy to get to realistically. So potentially, we've got it is local community can use it, but it opens up this area to do it. But the idea is to have it open from 6 a.m. till midnight. And more running like a gym. So you've got, because one of the things we used to say that Manchester, when it first opened, all downhill riders used to train on the track. Okay. Like Steve Pete, they all used to go to Manchester to train.
Yeah.
But no one can do that anymore. So it's, I mean, it's a good, it's Beat's gone on a turbo trainer, but winter training, it's perfect, isn't it? So the idea is to get 30 people every hour on there and just actually go intensively using it, really.
Cool.
And not elitist.
Yes, so that's yeah, the idea. And a welcoming place
yeah.
to be.
Yeah,
yeah. And how long would that take to build? Have you got a feel for it? What, if you start
once we start, it'd be still a couple of years once we start.
Okay,
but I think the priority would be to start the manufacturing underneath it first, because the right. idea is it'd be a 2-level building. So downstairs pays for the building because we need the space. Mm-hmm. The upstairs bit is extra; doesn't cost that much more to do it. And then the track would get fitted later.
Yeah,
As we got going.
Cool. That'd be exciting.
Yeah, yeah. Something different for the town.
Be good to see. Cool. So what's next for Hope then? You've got, obviously, the HB130 is imminent, but
yeah,
a few other bits and pieces.
We're working on more products. There's a few other little components in different areas we haven't got into at the moment. We're always working on improving other areas, like improvement on brakes. But it's like with the Tech 3 brakes, they're so good at the moment that there's no real reason to change them. We don't have product cycles on the products we do. We tend to just make a product. And if we start always in the background and developing more products, so we find something better, mm-hmm. we'll improve it
yeah.
and make the next one. Well, even during the course of a product, we'll actually might improve it as we go along, because it's all machined here and low production runs, we can evolve products as we go along if we find improvements we can make. Okay. Obviously, compatibility is an issue and fitting to make sure everyone knows what's yeah. going on with it, but we do it tightly with the cranks. They're very good ones we made, but as everyone will know, they were quite tricky to fit, sort of thing. Once they fitted, they're fine, but there was a few tools involved, that sort of thing. Whereas right. the new cranks, we evolved those, they're out next month, and they've got self-extracting, which is nothing revolutionary, really, but it just makes it a bit easier to fit and
yeah.
and just those sort of things. So we do various levels of changes as we go along.
Yeah, and some new rims come in?
Yes, new rims, those are out. That's one of the things we don't make here.
Right.
So we do buy the rims in. Uh-huh. They are designed, but they are manufactured in the Far East by a really good company that does good quality products. Yeah. Like over the years, done really good stuff for us. So and they're only our rims; they don't sell them to anybody else. Yeah. So we know we've got good control
and
over it.
Built in the house here.
Yes, yeah, so yeah. we get the rims in here, and we build all the wheels. They're all machine built; they're hand finished. So every wheel that has been built by a Barnoldic employee, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Good stuff. And like I mentioned earlier, I was lucky enough to have a look around the factory very recently.
Yeah.
You're, I think, starting to open that up a bit more and invite people for factory tours.
Yeah, we've always done tours for shops. So shops have brought their staff and customers around. Done that regularly. But what we're looking to do sometime in the near future is open up a bit more to public, so people can email us in and arrange tours for groups to come round. Maybe once a week we'll start doing that. And we'll start to open something to it. Because we noticed that anyone looks around, they still, even though we do videos about how things are made here, we'll do things like this, manufacture things in-house,
yeah.
it still surprises people at the level of things we can actually make in-house, even down to the rivets on the discs, the pad pins. The only thing we don't make is standard bolts.
Yeah.
But all the little screws and inserts in levers all get made in the factory downstairs. So I think people don't really believe it till they see it.
Yeah, it's cool to see.
Yeah, so it's good to sort of reinforce that with people
yeah.
as well.
Yeah, and some amazing machines doing very, very cool stuff down there.
Yeah, that's another thing. Not many companies have that diverse of processes, because we go from designing the products, the concepts and designs, right through to a box finish part going out of the building.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, good stuff. So if people want to get involved in that, they can drop an email into...
Yeah, just info@hopetech.com. Yeah. We'll put some diary dates in and just book people in.
Yeah.
Questions to go on.
All right.
We only do 10, maximum 10, because any more than that gets a bit hard work to manage, and people don't get as much out of it, really.
Or you'll lose them somewhere in the matrix downstairs.
Yes, we only lost a couple of people once.
It's pretty complicated down there.
Yeah.
Cool. All right, we're getting close to the end of our time, but we've got our three questions that we've asked most of our guests, so we'll hit you up with those. First of those is, if our listeners had £150 to improve their performance on a bike, what would you recommend they spend it on?
Probably one of the things that makes the biggest difference is good tyres.
Yeah.
Because you could destroy a ride or even a bike by putting bad tyres on.
Yeah.
Obviously, I would say the whole product, but realistically, I think the tyres is such an easy thing to change that people do mess up on quite often.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And do you have a favourite tyre?
I trust people who build the bikes for
me. Okay, you let them deal with that.
Yeah.
Fair enough. All right, second question. If you could wind back the clock and sit down with yourself age 16, what advice would you give him?
I'd say don't procrastinate.
Okay.
Tend to not, get on with things and complete things. When you set yourself a task, get on with it and do it.
Yeah.
I think people at the factory will understand that when I tell that one.
Okay, fair enough. And then the final question, if you could have a day's coaching from anyone, whether that's past or present, who would it be and what would you want to learn from them? And we can have a riding coach and then a separate coach if you want, like a more life skills.
Well, I suppose the riding one would be good though, because I've never ever been able to jump a bike.
Okay.
It's one of those things. You can ride it. I can leave the ground.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't.
Confidently.
Yeah. So it's one of those things. Someone like John Tomac to be able to tell you, there's such an all-round rider to be able to do anything. And just, just some skills of actually riding back. I can ride all right, but it'd be nice to have that confidence to do a bit more, keep up with the youngsters nowadays.
Yeah, that's fair
as
enough.
They say.
Yeah, cool. All right, good stuff. If people want to check out Hope and find out a bit more, so there's the website, which is...
Yeah, just hopetech.com.
Yeah, and social media?
We just Hope Tech on everything, basically, all platforms.
So people can find you there.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, good stuff. Well, thanks a lot for your time. It's been super interesting chatting, and it's great to have a look around the factory as well. So, yeah, wish you all the best for the future and hopefully a velodrome in a few years' time.
Yeah, no problem.
Awesome.
My pleasure, thank you.
Cheers.
Bye.
Right, that's it for this week's episode. I hope you've enjoyed listening and learning a bit more about Hope. It was super fascinating for me to have a look around and to chat with Alan. If you want to be one of the first people to go on a Hope factory tour, then drop an email over to info@hopetech.com and get involved. Thanks again to Hope for supporting this episode. Don't forget, if you want to check them out, then you can do that over at hopetech.com. Don't forget to give us a follow on social media, subscribe to the podcast because it will make your life easier. And if you fancy representing, then head to downtimepodcast.com/shop to grab yourself a t-shirt, hoodie, sweatshirt or mug and help spread the word. Oh, and don't forget to tell your friends too. Cheers. Right, we've got another awesome episode coming out real soon. But until then, get out and ride.